So now we get to hear about sunrise integrals and elliptic polylogarithms from Christian Bogner.
Yes, thank you. Thank you. So am I loud enough? I think yes. Thank you very much for the invitation. So in this talk I would like to discuss recent results on the massive sunrise integral, and this is joint work with Louisa Adams and Stefan Weinzierl. So we consider the famous tulip sunrise integral with particle masses assigned to all three propagators, and we allow these particle masses to be different from each other, and we compute the corresponding sunrise integral in two dimensions where it is finite and in four dimensions or near four dimensions, and here the pole terms have been known already. So again, we compute the epsilon zero coefficient of the Laurent expansion. In order to do that, at first we compute the epsilon coefficient of the two-dimensional result, and from here we will get to here. So this is what you will see near the end of this talk. Apart from the particle masses, the other important variable in our problem is called T here, and this is simply P squared, where P is the external momentum of the graph. So we are very interested in this particular Feynman integral because apparently it cannot be expressed in terms of multiple polylogarithms. You have seen in many talks now, and particularly in Eric Panzer's talk, that multiple polylogarithms provide a very useful framework for Feynman integral computations due to their double nature as nested sums and iterated integrals. And many Feynman integrals can be expressed in terms of this very general framework of functions. However, it seems not all of them. So people in the audience pointed out examples in n equal 4 super Young-Mills theory where this is not possible. And we also expect a whole family of massive Feynman integrals which drop out of this scheme. And the massive sunrise integral might be the simplest such case beyond multiple polylogarithms. So we use this as a showcase to study this problem and also to ask ourselves which are appropriate functions beyond multiple polylogarithms that we might use for such integrals. So before I come to our explicit computation, let me look at this problem from a few different perspectives and at the same time also recall some of the known facts about the sunrise integral. So from the mid-90s, there is already a result by Behrens, Butzer, Böhm, and Scharf. These people have been able to express the full sunrise integral for arbitrary particle masses and arbitrary dimension as a linear combination of certain generalized hypergeometric functions, which in this case are type C Lauricella functions. So these are three variable generalizations of hypergeometric functions. They are defined like this. And in their result, the dimension is still hidden in the arguments of this relatively complicated object. So what in principle we would like to do is to take this result and expand it near the dimension that we are interested in. However, this seems to be a problem. So, of course, you know that we have very powerful tools for the expansion of generalized hypergeometric functions and generalizations thereof. So recent work, for example, by Bitev, Kaimikov, and Moch even includes Horn-type functions and also Lauricella functions. But this particular type of Lauricella function still seems to be a problem. So at the moment, I think nobody has ever expanded such an object purely in terms of multiple polylogarithms, and this might tell us already that there might be a problem. So maybe a more precise statement can be obtained from looking at the Feynman parametric version of the Feynman integral. So we, for simplicity, look at the two-dimensional case here. So if we write our Feynman integral in terms of Feynman parameters, here we only have one polynomial sitting in the integrand, which in this case is the second semantic polynomial, and it looks like this. And what we would like to do here now is, in principle, we would like to integrate out one Feynman parameter after the other and build up the result as an iterated integral. This would be possible if the relevant polynomials in the integrand satisfy a criterion which we know by the name of linear reducibility. But if we look at this polynomial, we see that it's quadratic in all three of the parameters and it doesn't factorize, and therefore it fails this criterion. So at least in these variables, we cannot do, we cannot follow this method if nobody comes up with a smart change of variables, but nobody ever did, such that this linear reducibility would be restored, then this method cannot be used. And a third way to look at it, and it was nicely shown already in the talk by Lorenzo Tancredi, is to look at the differential equations. So for arbitrary dimension, the Feynman integral satisfies a fourth order differential equation. Here on the right hand side we have an inhomogeneous part given by some products of massive tadpole integrals. And now if we look at the coefficients in the epsilon expansion that we are interested in, so for example in the two-dimensional case, this coefficient satisfies a differential equation of second order, and these terms here of higher order. So however, if we look at these differential operators, we realize that they do not factorize purely in terms of first order operators. If this would be the case, again, we could simply build up our result by iterated integration, possibly in terms of multiple Polylogarithms. Logarithms, but the fact that they do not factorize tells us that we maybe have to expect something else. So nevertheless, the differential equations approach is useful for us to obtain analytical results, and this is what we will follow in this talk. So we look at the two-dimensional case again in the beginning. Let me briefly mention what other people have done in the equal mass case. So here a second-order differential equation was already known for a long time, and many people have provided results in terms of different setups of functions. So I just want to mention a few here because these results are somehow related to what you will see on the later slides. But there are many people here to be mentioned, in fact. So we are interested in the arbitrary mass case, and here the situation seems to be a bit more complicated. For a long time, the state of the art was, with respect to differential equations, a coupled system of four differential equations of first order. Therefore, it was an important step in 2012 when Weinzierl, Müller-Stach, and Zayadeh found that also in this case, like above here, also in the arbitrary mass case, one second-order differential equation is satisfied by the Feynman integral. So here, the coefficients are just some polynomials in our variable t and our squared particle masses, and on the right-hand side, we furthermore have some logarithms in the squared particle masses. This is the starting point of our computation. Now, in the first approach to solve this, we simply make a classical ansatz by a variation of constants. So we just say that our result should be of this form here. Psi 1, psi 2 are the solutions, or are two solutions of the homogeneous differential equation. They should appear together with some constants that we have to determine. And here is the so-called particular solution, also where the integrand is built up by these homogeneous solutions, also sitting here in this Wronsky determinant. So this is also determined by the homogeneous solutions, and here are some coefficients of our equation. So our first thing that we have to do is to determine these homogeneous solutions. For this purpose, it's already useful to look at the underlying geometry of the problem, which is again given by the second semantic polynomial that you have already seen. So we consider the zero set, or in other words, the variety of this polynomial, or to be more precise, it's a cubical curve, and we find that it intersects the integration domain only at three points. So these three points here in the Feynman parameters are somehow special in this problem, and I also come back to them in the end of this talk. At the moment, we just take one of them, choose it as the origin of our geometrical object defined in this way, and this defines it to be an elliptic curve. So now we have an elliptic curve, and we can write it in Weierstrass normal form and associate the typical mathematical objects that one can relate to an elliptic curve, and for us it turns out to be useful to look at the period integrals of this elliptic curve. So how do we obtain those? We look at the chart z equals 1, then this cubical polynomial in x factorizes in three terms, and the three zeros define us some boundaries of an integration where we integrate over closed differential forms defined on the elliptic curve, and this canonical definition gives us period integrals of this curve. Now, these period integrals in this case are known to evaluate to elliptic, complete elliptic integrals of the first kind, which are defined like this. So this is some known object. And all of this is useful for us because these period integrals are solutions of the homogeneous differential equation. So this can be easily checked, but also it's, I think, known mathematics, so we follow, so to say, some standard paths of mathematics on elliptic curves, and these solutions drop out of that. What else do we have to do? We have to fix these constants. One of these constants is fixed by looking at one of the properties of such a period integral. The other constant is fixed by comparison with the result at t equals 0, which was obtained long ago by Davidychev and Tausk. So this is enough to fix these constants. And now, in principle, we have determined everything that we need to build up our result. There are a few more technical details. In fact, we don't only look at two period integrals, but at all four of them that one can define. And this allows us for simplifications of our integral. However, the bottom line of this computation is that we obtain the two-dimensional result as an integral over a combination of complete elliptic integrals of the first and second type. Now, this is related to the work that I cited previously by Grote and Pivovarov and also by Laporta and Remidi. So these people also have used, in the equal mass case, integrals over elliptic integrals to build up their results. This framework of functions has a disadvantage. Elliptic integrals are very well known in mathematics, but apparently integrals over elliptic integrals are not. So it seems that nobody ever had a strong reason to look at integrals over elliptic integrals, or not so many people. And in particular, we do not have a framework of iterated integrals built up by such functions. This is a bit disappointing. We would like to have something which is a bit closer to the multiple polylogarithm world. And from this point of view, it was interesting for us to see that in 2013, Spencer Bloch and Pierre van Hove looked at the equal mass case again, computed it again, and obtained a result in terms of something which they call elliptic dilogarithm. So this also gave us the idea, maybe it's also possible for our arbitrary mass case to apply functions which are such elliptic dilogarithms, whatever that means. And before I come to that, let me discuss the simple concept of an elliptic function at first, just in general. So let's say I look at the complex plane at some complex variable x, and in this complex plane I define a lattice by two vectors, one pointing along the real axis of length 1 and the other vector defined by some complex variable tau. This should have positive imaginary parts such that this really spans the whole complex plane. Now, a function is called elliptic with respect to such a lattice if it satisfies this relation here. So if I add some point of the lattice to the argument, this should not change the value of the function. So this means that if I compute the function here, I obtain the same value at every other point that I obtain by integer multiples of shifts along these two vectors here. So this means that if I just restrict my attention to one of these cells of the lattice, I already know everything about this function because everything else is just going to be copies of that. So I can say I restrict the function just on this one standard cell here and just study it there because then I already know everything about it. So what's the relation to elliptic curves? If this number tau here is now a fraction of two periods of an elliptic curve, then this standard cell here is isomorphic to the corresponding elliptic curve, and then I can say my elliptic function is really considered to be defined on this elliptic curve. So this is the concept that we want to have. We want to have a function that is defined on an elliptic curve. Let's look at this in a slightly different way. We make a change of variables. This was our variable x. Now we look at the exponential function of this and take this to be our new variable. So our ellipticity condition, which was something obtained by adding this lattice point here in the argument, now in this new variable becomes something with multiplying here in the argument. So if I multiply by q, where q is this exponential function of such a lattice point, then my function should not change. In particular, I'm interested, of course, in such a q where tau is in the exponent, and this tau is just a fraction of these two periods. Okay, now, how do we construct such functions? There are different ways of doing that, but there's one very simple idea. Let's say we take some function, and from this we construct an elliptic function by evaluating the function at z times q to the power of n and taking the sum over all n, over all integers n. This means if I multiply with some q here in the argument, this term is already contained in the sum, so I do not change anything about this function. So by definition, this is going to be an elliptic function, if I can make sense out of that. So this nearly looks too simple to make any sense, but people can use this to define elliptic polylogarithms. So, for example, Brown and Levin in their paper set up the class of elliptic polylogarithms exactly in this way. They take the classical polylogarithms evaluated at z times q to the power n and sum over all n. Here is an auxiliary factor in front of it, some damping factor, which is supposed to be small enough such that this whole thing here converges. So in this way, they define elliptic polylogarithms, elliptic multiple polylogarithms, and the most interesting thing about their work is that they also set up a framework of iterated integrals for such functions. But they were not the first people to discuss elliptic polylogarithms. It goes all back to work by Spencer Bloch in the 70s. Now, for our purpose, we are using the same concept, but define the function in a slightly different way. So we start again by looking at the classical polylogarithm, and we say, okay, we have to introduce further variables and such a q here. And if we do it like this, then you see that we obtain exactly the form that you have seen on the previous slide by Brown and Levin, just for the one difference that we sum from 1 to infinity and not over the negative integers. But then we take a combination of our objects to be our really interesting function that we really want to use. And here in this combination, we combine these objects evaluated at the arguments and at the inverses of these arguments, and this somehow restores the summation over the negative integers again, up to some difference. So for example, in the case of the dial logarithm, this is our function that we obtain in this way. It's exactly the thing that Brown and Levin define, up to a sum over some squared logarithms and constants, so of functions of lower weight. Okay, however, this function is exactly tailored to solve the sunrise integral. So using this function, this here is our result for the two-dimensional sunrise integral. Here in front you still see one of these complete elliptic integrals. So this is not an integral over an elliptic integral anymore. This is really just the known elliptic integral. And all the rest is now the sum of three copies of our elliptic dial logarithm evaluated at three different arguments. And these three arguments are, of course, functions of the particle masses. I think I do not have enough time to discuss this in detail, but they are also nicely related to our elliptic curve. So you remember that in the beginning we had these three intersection points, and then we went through all of these changes of variables transforming our elliptic curves, and if we apply all of these changes of variables to these intersection points, we land at these three arguments. So I think we are very satisfied with this result because it looks very compact, and everything in here is somehow related to the geometry of this underlying elliptic curve. Now, in the last 5 minutes, I come to our four-dimensional result. So you remember we have now computed this thing. Now we want to compute this, and in order to do that, we first have to compute this because we arrive there by Tarasov's dimensional shift relations. So these relations tell us that we can express this object here as a linear combination of these two and all of their differentiations with respect to the three particle masses. So we have to compute this here also analytically in order to obtain the set of master integrals in the Tarasov sense. So how do we obtain that? Firstly, this object satisfies the fourth order differential equation, but this operator here on the left-hand side factorizes into a first order, two first order pieces and one second order operator. So we can solve this for some second order differential equation, where now the right-hand side is a bit more complicated than previously. So previously on the right-hand side, we had just a polylogarithm involving some, a polynomial involving some logarithms. Now we have already two integrations here in the inhomogeneous part on the right-hand side, so this is a bit more complicated. But this operator here is exactly the same as in this case. So we can use similar techniques that we have used here to obtain our result for the epsilon coefficient of the two-dimensional case, and this directly provides the epsilon zero coefficient of the four-dimensional case. It's too long to be shown here, but I just want to highlight a few functions that appear in these results. So first of all, we also have our elliptic dilogarithm again. Then we have an elliptic logarithm. Then we have some function of weight 4, which also arises from our framework, which we have used to define these objects. And then we have a more complicated object written as a quadruple sum. So just as a last remark on these functions, here again is our framework, which we have used to define these elliptic polylogarithms. You can make a connection to Clausen and Gleicher functions. So if you look at these combinations here that we have used to build up our functions, then it might remind you of the classical definition of the Clausen function and the Gleicher function, where also you have polylogarithms and polylogarithms evaluated at the inverse of the argument, like here. So with the only difference that here we generalize this to the elliptic. So therefore, we can also see that our function elliptic logarithm in the limit of q going to 0 is just the first Clausen function. Our elliptic dilogarithm in this limit is the second Clausen function. And this new object here of weight 4 is the generalization of the third Gleicher function. So I think I have maybe two more minutes or something, but this is just enough for conclusions. So you have seen that the elliptic curve defined by the second semantic polynomial of the Feynman graph has been useful for the computation of this Feynman integral. We have directly obtained these period integrals from it, but we also have a feeling of how we should set up a useful set of elliptic generalizations of polylogarithms. And in our result in the two-dimensional case, we have used the elliptic dilogarithm, where the arguments are also directly obtained from this geometrical setup. In the four-dimensional case, the geometry becomes more complicated. Here, the first semantic polynomial is also in the integrand, so this somehow mixes with the second one, so we lose track a bit of how the correspondence to the geometry should work. But nevertheless, the framework that we have set up here also turns out to be useful here. So here we also find a result in terms of functions in our framework of elliptic generalizations of polylogarithms. I think there are two interesting open questions about that. So first of all, of course, can we use such a framework for the computation of further Feynman integrals? And I hope that this will turn out to be true. And the second question, can we write such functions in terms of iterated integrals? So this question should be related to the work of Brown and Levin, but also to the work of Brödel, Mafra, Mattes, which is just written with two T's here, and Oliver Schlotterer, whose talk you will hear in 2 minutes. So thank you for your attention.
So we have time for our...
So maybe two questions. The first one, so if I understood correctly from your last comment, there is no integral representation for these functions yet. So there is only a representation in terms of multiple sums.
So what we have is a representation in terms of multiple sums. But as we are very close to this multiple sum of Brown and Levin, there's hope to write this as iterated integrals, because in their work they have proven that, so they have set up a framework of iterated integrals, and they have proven a statement that this framework should be enough to represent these functions. But they do not tell us the exact recipe of how our function, so for example our elliptic dialogue rhythm, should look in terms of these integrals.
Means that they don't give the exact kernel of the integration.
They do, but it's complicated still to see how to write these objects. So they provide generating functions for the differential forms of the iterated integrals. So all the iterated integrals, and I think Oliver will talk about this, so all of these kernels are determined.
Okay, and then something, sorry, very quick. So explicitly, when you do the integration, you do it integrating the differential equation or just integrating the Feynman parameters representation? When you
just a differential equation. We do not integrate in Feynman parameters.
Okay.
All right, I don't see any more questions, so let's thank our speaker for...